this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and friends to make your lives a little bit easier. So tonight, I have a special in-studio guest. Her name is Dr. Michelle Harris, and I am happy to have her on board. We are going to talk about childhood grief and loss this evening. And if you would like to join us in this conversation, our number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. So welcome, Dr. Harris. How are you doing?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for having me tonight, Julianne.
Well, thank you for being in studio. It's so nice to have somebody that I can actually look at and ask questions directly versus being on phone. So I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
So can you tell the listeners about your background?
Sure. I am currently a licensed psychologist. I'm a pediatric psychologist, and my background is in health psychology broadly. So what that means, it's kind of this intersection between physical health, mental health, and kind of how to deal with how those two are related. And so my specific interest is in working with kids. Mm-hmm. And so I have, after moving from Texas in 2008, I took a predoctoral internship and then completed a postdoctoral fellowship at Children's Hospital Los Angeles in pediatric psychology. So lots of experience working with kids with a host of chronic health conditions. Since then, I am teaching now at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. This is my fourth year, and where I'm doing pediatric health psychology as well as some other areas. So it's been a wonderful adventure.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm not in Texas anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something to be said about that, I guess,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Very different.
Yeah. And it's impressive. CHLA, that's a great hospital.
Yeah. No, I have such beautiful memories. I actually have a chance to do a little bit of consultation with them and really enjoy being able to work in the hospital environment.
Yeah, and that takes a lot of gusto to be able to work in a hospital environment.
Mm-hmm. I think if you can work in a hospital environment because of the pace and also the things that you see and smell and interact with, then you can almost work anywhere.
Yes, you can.
So it's a great training ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've worked in several hospitals over several years and a couple of ER rotations. And yeah, it's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, intense, but rewarding.
Absolutely.
So what got you impassioned to be working with pediatric grief and loss?
Yeah, if you had asked me probably about 5 years ago, I would have never thought that my career would have taken this turn. While I was in Texas, I actually had an opportunity to work at MD Anderson Cancer Center, which provides care for adults as well as children. And my job there was working as an educational liaison. So I was really responsible for helping kids transition from the hospital back to their community schools. And I did a lot of consultation with teachers to help the kids be successful. Unfortunately, after working with a few kids, some of them died. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity on one occasion to actually kind of be in the room with a child as he expired. And I remember having this feeling of, why didn't that sting me in the way that I thought that it may have? So if you flash forward a couple more years, I accepted the internship at Children's Hospital LA. And I started noticing as I worked with different patients that when it came to talking about grief and loss and working with kids who were terminally ill, there was the same feeling of, I feel at home, and it just felt very comfortable, as well as I recognized in working with the families that there was such a missing link in terms of being able to provide support there. And since then, I would say for the past three and a half years, my entire career has been dedicated to addressing grief, helping families cope with loss, and just getting the word out in the community about the importance of addressing this issue.
Mm-hmm. It is very important, yeah, because it's part of life. And mm-hmm. Yeah, and little ones also get terminally sick, which is very sad, but it is a fact of life. So did you have any prior experiences that made you feel like this was your niche, this was your comfort zone?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've definitely dealt with personal losses in my family. Mm-hmm. And this first incident with this child at the cancer center, it didn't really resonate that my prior experience and this moment were linked. But I will say that over the course of my work with the kids, I experienced additional personal losses. And I think my personal experiences coupled with what I had learned from the families really let me know that this is absolutely a need, that someone has to kind of pick up the mic and bring a voice to like death and dying in the community. As you said, it's something we all face. And I just felt like that person was me. And I'm really thankful that I've been able to use that mouthpiece over the years.
And that's a gift.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that a lot of people would have a hard time doing that type of work just because it's so sensitive and you're dealing with so many family issues, mm-hmm. you know, besides the illness.
Yeah.
So what else do some of these families that you've worked with mm-hmm. bring to the table when they're dealing with a child who has a terminal illness?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a host of variables that come into play. Cultural variables, whether that be race and ethnicity, issues of spirituality often come up at end of life. So when my child dies, where is he or she going? And how do I appreciate that and fit that within this process? As well as families' own styles of coping with grief and loss. So I think a lot of the work is around helping families really make meaning in the days, weeks, months leading up to their child's death. And then, so when the child does die, there is a way to memorialize them, and it's a way for the family to come together in a very meaningful way that they can then reflect upon for the remainder of their lives.
On average, how long do you work with a family?
That's a really good question. When I first started working with kiddos, one of the things that a lot of families said was there's a lot of support around the weeks, months leading up to the child's death, and then the weeks, month, maybe following the child's death. However, once that initial support is gone, a lot of families reported feeling very isolated. You know, if they interacted with family and friends, no one wanted to bring up the child because then they didn't want to provoke some emotional response. And so it left the families feeling as if their child never existed. And I really took that to heart as I worked with families in the hospital. So in private practice, I really promote a very long term. I've worked with kiddos for a year or families for a year up to 2 years beyond their child's death mm-hmm. to really help them, you know, how do we recreate the meaning of our family? How do we then reintegrate ourselves back into the community? And how do we keep the spirit of our child alive in the face of a community that doesn't really want to talk about death and loss?
Right. It seems like it's almost a taboo subject mm-hmm. for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think the way that, particularly in Western culture, we really struggle with addressing the reality of how finite we are. But if we listen to the news, obviously we're constantly bombarded with death in the media. So we've got to be able to talk about that. And so families aren't walking away feeling isolated.
So when you're working with the families, are you doing psychoeducation, you're kind of maybe stepping them through the process of what's going to happen and bringing up any emotions that they have, any fears.
Mm-hmm. So I one way to look at this is almost kind of pre-death, right around the time of death, and then kind of in the long term. So some of the things that I'm really mindful of before the child dies is really assessing what those family strengths are, because those are the things that are going to carry them into the child's death as well as beyond their death. So really getting a sense of who's in the family, what are the relation dynamics between people in the family, how do we communicate, getting the family together to create some sort of meaning, whether it be a scrapbook. So almost memorializing that child and including them in that process so that they can feel that they are heard even in the process of dying. And then once a child's died, then it really is understanding what are the resources available to them. Are there community supports or family supports that can help them be very supported and emotionally uplifted throughout that phase? And then helping the family kind of forecast, you know, what might this look like in the months and days ahead of you? And how can we kind of think about how to put all of our resources in place so that when that time comes, you're not feeling isolated?
Yeah, instead of being shocked by the situation, you're helping to build up their resiliency.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, for some families, it can be a little off-putting to kind of think about how they may be responding in the months following the death. But as I've worked with families over time, I've really heard them say how beneficial that was, because it wasn't as if they were experiencing these moments out of the blue, that they had already thought through what will happen when, you know, a month after your child dies, when the phones stop, when people stop coming over, perhaps, how will you still be able to keep your emotional reserve there in the absence of that?
Mm-hmm. And then they're prepared. And when a child has a terminal illness, it's the whole structure, the daily structure changes radically.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about siblings reconsidering their roles. You know, parent, if it's a parent or parents of a sole child, what does that mean for mom and dad when there's not a child in the home? So really talking about role differentiation and what that's going to look like moving forward, and how can we redefine ourselves in the midst of your child's death?
Yeah, it's restructuring the family.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine too that for a couple that it's their only child, and maybe if they're a little bit older, and can't have more children, that's got to be a huge impact right there. And I would think that it would impact them as a couple.
Absolutely. When you look at the kind of the statistics related to the marriages lasting, I think in the general population, it's one out of every two couples ends in divorce. Mm-hmm. And when you add this stress of having a child with a chronic health condition or a terminal illness, those numbers rise. And so part of the planning is also talking about, as a couple, how can we increase our communication, our connection, so that in the face of the loss, we're actually coming together as opposed to splintering to cope with the death.
That's got to be a huge working, and just from that issue, because couples therapy is one of the most difficult therapies to do, period, across the board. And you're right, when you add this extra huge stressor, I mean, that's got to be tricky for you.
Yeah, and I think the most challenging part when working with couples and or families is everyone copes with grief differently. And so, again, back to the planning part, it's figuring out how I cope when in the face of stress. Am I a person who cries? Am I a person who kind of goes inward? Do I express that in anger? And so really appreciating that there's no right or wrong. And following the death, how are we then going to respect and honor each person's expression while at the same time being able to come together as a family to support each other?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you find that cultural differences in that area really make a difference as to how culturally, you know, appropriate it is to be grieving in public and to be grieving in front of other family members?
Absolutely. I have definitely worked with a broad array of families, thinking about culture beyond race, but if we're specifically talking about race and ethnicity, absolutely have seen some very clear differences in terms of emotional expression. Is bringing up the loss a sense of honoring the person, or is that a signal of distress? So you definitely do have to take into account all these different cultural variables and have those conversations, as well as appreciate your own values as a therapist, engaging with them so that you can really honor their child in the way that's most meaningful for them.
Yes, and it is honoring their memory once they pass.
Absolutely.
And Yeah, it's got to be difficult. We are going to take a commercial break. We are going to be back with Dr. Mikhail Harris.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. If you would like to join us in our conversation about childhood loss and grief, our number again is 800-893-9562. And this is Julianne Good, back with Dr. Mikhail Harris. Hi.
Hi.
So my next question for you is, what are some of the signs and symptoms of childhood grief and loss?
Okay, so to unpack that question, I think we have to think about the child's age, because depending on if we're talking about a little one versus an adolescent, those signs and symptoms might look very different. For kiddos less than 10 years of age, you might notice, families may notice things like behavioral outbursts. When we think about an adult in terms of grief and loss and sadness, we tend to think about crying and sadness and more kind of internalized things. In children, that might manifest in behavior issues. And so a kiddo who's grieving may, you know, get into more fights at school, might be a little bit more combative or disruptive in some way. So that may be one sign. You may also notice some of the traditional crying and withdrawal from social situations and limited communication with peers and so forth. I think the main thing that parents and families have to be mindful of is thinking about their child before the loss, and evaluating, is this typical for my kiddo? Would my child have responded in this way before the loss? And how is he responding now? And that really becomes kind of the baseline, the marker from which to determine if something's really problematic or if this is just a kind of a typical sign and symptom of grief.
And then the side effects of the medication too have to be taken into account as to how they're going to be changing the personality and the behavior of the child.
Yes. Now, this is assuming that after the loss that a sibling, for example, is exhibiting kind of more depressive symptoms that would warrant more intervention. Mm-hmm. And if that is the case, then, you know, psychotherapy might be suggested. Medication may be appropriate. In most cases, when we're talking about grief and loss, we expect that kiddos are going to perhaps behaviorally regress or become more immature. So we expect this pattern of behavior. The large majority of kids actually tend to fare very well and kind of move through the cycles of grief in a very typical fashion and then exhibit resiliency on the back end. So this conversation is really about those kiddos that are struggling and really exhibiting more long-term problems over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, are you referring to the siblings or the patient or both?
Both.
Okay.
So I think my experience is clinically working with kiddos is that the extent to which they're invited into the conversation about their own death, so we're talking about the patient, and the extent to which the families are open about communicating yields more positive outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So I have worked with parents who are very reticent about talking about death, and in my conversations with them, it's been around, you know, processing what is it about not talking about it and what is the anxiety around that. Sometimes when it's not addressed with the dying child, him or herself, that child is actually building in their anxiety and they're kind of thinking way worse outcomes than there may possibly be. So to have that conversation out in the open can actually reduce some of the anxiety symptoms that they feel and also make them feel like they're part of the decision making, right, around their own death which is very important.
Yeah, that's very important. Yeah. I mean, it's a hard conversation to have, but, mm-hmm. you know, you need to include, it's their lives,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. you know, and for they, I just to have a little bit of control
absolutely.
Over what they are feeling and thinking and, you know, this got to be monumentous, really.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the greatest challenges of working with kids with chronic health conditions that may or may not be terminally ill is the lack of control that they feel. Not having control over the diagnosis itself, not having control over perhaps having to miss school and limit their peer interactions, not having control over their treatment. And so death can become a place where they can actually exercise their voice and say how they want to be remembered. So including kiddos in developing the scrapbook for themselves. What songs do you want played at your funeral? What are the things that are valuable for you throughout this process? And how can we make that possible? It gives them a huge sense of control and allows them to experience death in the most positive way possible.
So with the patients that you work with, mm-hmm. how much do they get into the process of saying, you know what, I don't want that treatment anymore. I don't want that medication anymore. Stop doing that. It hurts me. It, mm-hmm. you know, start voicing, you know, medical decision-making, basically.
Oh, Julianne, this is such a can of worms. So there's lots of kind of ethics around decision-making. And, you know, as a professional, we're always thinking of doing the most good for our patients, mm-hmm. not doing harm, and also fostering a sense of autonomy. When we're talking about kids, for example, that are 9 years of age, what does that look like? And are those kids cognitively, emotionally ready to be able to make decisions about end-of-life considerations? It's a very gray area, but I think that it's a great conversation to have with families so that, again, that child can be honored and given as much control as possible in a situation that's very difficult.
Yeah, especially with treatments that are consistently giving them pain, but ultimately is for their benefit because
yes.
it's extending their lives.
Yeah.
Or, you know, initially it's painful, but then they go on and it actually lessens the pain. So
yeah.
do you have to come in and have the pain conversations also?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one example is for like cancer treatment. So we are administering a set of drugs that's designed to kill these cancerous tumors. At the same time, there's lots of pain and discomfort associated with that. And so from the very beginning, talking with the family about those two polar opposites and saying, you know, what do we do with this? And to what extent do we want to pursue treatment in light of the fact that we're aware of these potential complications? So just keeping everything out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It is.
Very, very difficult. I really admire that you're able to do this work.
I am constantly amazed by the children and the families with whom I interact. And I have been shocked in some ways with myself thinking about just all the obstacles they face, the rapid decision-making that they have to deal with, as well as just coping with the death and loss itself. But I continue to pursue this work because what I see is an amazing amount of resilience and just a true tenacity of the human spirit that really helps to put my own life in perspective, as well as appreciate the interactions that I do have with these kiddos and families.
So how are these families and patients referred to you?
So I currently work in private practice in Pasadena, California, and the majority of the patients that I see now are referred through Huntington Hospital, which is in Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
I also work with children of adult patients. So if a mom or dad may be experiencing a terminal illness, helping that child cope with the loss of their parent as well as just community referrals through other colleagues.
So on the flip side then, mm-hmm. when you're working with children who have parents with terminal illnesses,
mm-hmm.
what's the different, arc of doing therapy in that case?
I think that there are similarities in terms of the amount of advanced planning that goes into the treatment. So as you would with a child who is terminally ill, have that conversation with their parents, having the conversation with the child to say, you know, this is kind of the path that we are probably trending towards. Let's talk about decision making. Let's talk about roles. Let's talk about what will happen even practically. So if someone dies, that may result in moves, and kind of thinking about practical matters. So it's similar in that sense. I think the difference is just depending on the age of the child, the ability to really kind of process what's really happening. For little kids, there may be a much less ability to appreciate all the complexities of what death is involved. So really looking at it from a developmental perspective is very important.
So in that case with little ones, mm-hmm. would you have like coloring books and kind of activities to get them to start slowly processing it? Because it's really tricky mm-hmm. working with little ones.
Yeah, I think for little kids, it's definitely important to utilize more expressive arts therapies that may include art, like physically drawing, having them create stories and kind of do more of a narrative therapy. You might also utilize that with an older child, but helping that child have a voice in a way that is appropriate for them developmentally is important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you're working with children in that case, are there issues of, well, especially if their fathers die, where, and it's a male, mm-hmm. you know, a male child, or probably the oldest one, where they feel like they're going to have to take the place of the father and they're going to have to be put in that parentified position?
Yes. So I think, and this is back to your question around kind of cultural differences, I think that that definitely can erupt. So I think my role in that situation is to almost help kind of forecast, you know, what will this look like and how can we still maintain that child's role in a situation where he may, in fact, have to, you know, increase the level of responsibilities in the home while at the same time not becoming the parent or kind of a friend to mom, let's say. So it's a very delicate kind of conversation around roles and boundaries and also allowing that child to be a child,
yeah.
in effect.
Yeah, yeah, because that would be a difficult loss, and to feel that much responsibility as a child that mm-hmm. you have to replace of you know, a parent who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult.
Yeah, I've also seen just some of the challenges with the surviving parent and the child in terms of communication. So one or the other not wanting to bring up the death of the loved one for fear that the other one may not be able to cope with that. And if I bring it up, then am I really equipped to be able to provide support? So then nothing is said. So again, I think a lot of conversations around how to have those communications in a safe place and how to talk about the differences and how family members communicate about death is absolutely critical.
Yeah. So what's the largest family you've ever worked with?
When I was a fellow at Children's Hospital LA, I worked with a family of eight, a Latino family, where a kiddo, the child died, a female sibling died, and there were six siblings and then the two surviving parents. And that was really interesting, particularly over time. In the interim, I think they did respond very similarly in terms of how they were grieving. But over time, it looked very different. So kind of going back to this conversation around the different ways to express grief, the different ways to communicate about it, and the different ways to memorialize the death of the loved one. Mm-hmm. I know for some of the siblings, going to the cemetery was very important to physically be able to visit, whereas some, that provoked a really negative response. So how can we come together as a family and view this memorialization differently was, you know, ongoing conversation with them.
And then having to have respect for each individual and how they are going to deal with the loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one really important conversation is helping each family member realize that while they may receive a certain type of support for their from their family members, to also think about other people outside of their family system. Because it may not be that, you know, your sibling or your mom can provide the support in a way that's meaningful for you, but how can they meet a need, and how can someone else, perhaps at school or perhaps in a different environment, meet your emotional needs so that it's being met in full, perhaps not always by one person. Mm-hmm. So this is where we get into like talking about peer relationships and, you know, church affiliation and other things that are meaningful in the community that may be beneficial for them.
And also incorporating some kind of humor and fun along the way to just lighten up the burden.
Yeah, I think humor is really interesting. I'm thinking about this along cultural lines. Mm-hmm. So humor has been definitely found as one source of coping as a strategy. The timing of humor obviously depends on that family. So kind of back to this planning phase of, let's kind of think about, once this death occurs, what are the things that are most meaningful for you? And as a therapist, trying to implement those things that are meaningful in terms of coping, as well as helping the family expand their repertoire, kind of their menu of coping strategies, is really important.
Yeah, and going out and having fun and doing, quote, normal life.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, wherever they can, mm-hmm. just to lighten up the load.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, one thing that families can struggle with is kind of getting back into a family routine. But if we look at some of the research literature around grief and loss, it's important that following the loss, that those routines actually be maintained, even though there's lots of chaos going on at that time, so that it's subtly communicating to the self that there's hope, that life will continue beyond that person's death, and that I will be able to move forward successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that over time, the death will be viewed differently. Mm-hmm. It will be a little less painful as time goes on. Mm-hmm. So the emotional processing is allowed to surface and leave, because yeah. It is part of the life process and the life cycle that, you know, these deaths occur. So,
one thing I do want to comment on is I think historically we have looked at grief and death in a very stage-wise fashion. Mm-hmm. So everyone's probably maybe familiar with like Kubler-Ross and kind of these stages of death and dying. That's really not in kind of the contemporary way of understanding death, the way that it's really viewed. It's really viewed in a more of a kind of not a stepwise progression, but a very cyclical progression. So someone may start off in denial, and there may be anger. They might cycle back through denial and acceptance. And so it really is a vacillating wave-like experience of grief, as opposed to chronological linear progression through the stages.
That's good to know, because you're right. I think a lot of people are locked into that. It's the five stages, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So they are locked into, okay, well, I should be at this stage now, but I'm at this stage. And, you know, like you said, a linear progression. Yeah. And they might get a little tripped up if they're not progressing through that like they think they should be. But you're right, it goes back and forth.
Absolutely. And I think that the message really is to communicate to families is that grief is a lifelong journey. That, you know, I think in kind of the public domain and popular culture, it really is, are you going to get over that? And really, that's not possible to get over a death. It's, how can I integrate this loss and make meaning within my current life functioning? But it really will be a lifelong process, and I probably will vacillate between many different phases, you know, depending on where I am in my stage of life.
And would you say it's important also for the survivors, mm-hmm. to realize that the person that has died would like them to continue on, would like them to have happy, mm-hmm. and joyous lives, mm-hmm. up ahead, and to remember that process, that the person who passed would not want them grieving for them for the rest of their lives?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important conversation to have before the person dies with the dying person. So really helping them, if it's possible, to articulate what their wishes are for the survivors so that it's not kind of a contrived, you know, we have to move forward because your loved one would have wanted that. It really is, we had this conversation and, you know, how did your loved one want your life to then continue beyond their death? And thinking about ways to memorialize, honor, and make meaning in their life, to kind of incorporate the death as part of their daily experience.
And thank you for adding to that body versus, yeah. You know, because I think a lot of people do have that conception about, mm-hmm. well, you know, that person would have wanted me to move forward, mm-hmm. you know, and I think sometimes people, the survivors feel almost guilty if they're moving forward too fast or...
Yes.
You know, and it's all within their own time frame. It's
absolutely.
Like,
yeah, you know. Grief is definitely not a race. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. And so I think that as survivors are experiencing whatever their grief looks like, as a therapist to honor wherever that is, of course, you know, you're wanting that person to definitely not have their functional life impaired. But honoring that I still feel angry about the death, or I may feel angry at the person who died, and that's okay. Really thinking of how can I use this in a meaningful way, whatever that feeling is. So it really is about honoring and not assigning guilt or putting time frames on the grief process.
Yeah. Yeah, or doing the I should or I have to or, mm-hmm. you know, just letting the process happen naturally.
Yeah,
and being honest with it.
Yeah, which is a huge shift in the way our culture has really viewed death and dying for so long, because it is, there's a start point and there's an end point. And so part of, you know, I feel like my charge and others who are involved in this grief loss, this body of work is to really help communicate that's not the way that we need to be communicating about it, that it really is a process and a lifelong experience.
It is. And we are going to break for a little while here. We're going to do a little musical break, and we will be back with Dr. Mikhail Harris. Thank you.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
Oh,
welcome back to Psych One-on-One with Julianne Good and Dr. Mikael Harris. We are talking about childhood loss and grief, and we're talking about when families experience terminal illnesses with their children, or the children have parents who have terminal illnesses. What can we do when we're going through that process if this is happening to us or our loved ones or our friends? And how can we help them? And because death is a natural process of life. All of us will die eventually. So I think just to learn how to go through the process and as conscientious of a timeline as possible is really helpful for so many people, versus feeling overwhelmed and isolated and you don't know what to do. So, Dr. Harris, mm-hmm. Is therapy always necessary after children suffer a loss?
The easy answer is yes and no. So previously I was talking about, you know, families really being aware of kind of where their child was before their sibling suffered a loss, or where they even were before and where they are post-death. And so I think the answer to that depends on the extent to which there's a functional impairment. So am I having difficulty getting up and going to work? Am I having a hard time doing my daily activities? Is it really having an impact on my day-to-day experience? That may be a little bit more of a clinical impression that, yes, maybe I need to see a therapist. But as I mentioned, it is completely typical for kiddos to experience the host of depressive symptoms, whether that look like crying and withdrawal or the behavioral outburst across the lifespan. So I think a lot of this really depends on the individual child and family member. Mm-hmm. I think that it can be wise to seek counsel from a therapist who can kind of give some guidance on, is this typical for this time frame, or is this something that we probably want to kind of keep our eyeball on a little bit longer? So I think the answer is yes and no.
Mm-hmm. To get as much information as possible, mm-hmm. to empower the decision-making process.
Absolutely.
And then to also help to have discussions with the healthcare providers, because some healthcare providers can be rather clinical and cold. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of part of their jobs.
Yeah. I think it's also important to identify what that family's already doing and what's already meaningful for them. For example, if the family's really involved, for example, in their church, you know, what are some things that are already in place that we might be able to utilize in lieu of traditional psychotherapy that still may meet the same goal of you being able to experience support.
Mm-hmm. So trying to incorporate as many outside people as possible.
Absolutely.
For support system.
Yeah, I think when it comes to grief and loss, as we say with children, it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to really support a person who's grieving so that they do feel supported over the course of their grief journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what agencies and other healthcare practitioners have you worked with during this process?
Yeah, so when I was at Children's, we frequently made referrals to a couple of community-based grief and bereavement camps. One of those is Comfort Zone Camp. So Comfort Zone Camp is a community-based camp for children roughly ages 7 to 17, and it's an opportunity for kids who are grieving to attend either a 1 or 3 day camp to interact with kids who've also suffered a loss. And the losses may be a host of losses, so tragic losses to cancer and so forth, but it really is the safe kind of holding environment for kids to say, I'm here, I have a safe place to share my story of loss. I'm also going to develop some coping tools to take home, and I'm also going to be in the presence of a skilled clinician to facilitate a discussion about all of these things so that when I go home, I almost have like a toolkit of sorts. So that's one community agency. There are many other bereavement camps for kids. Our House and Camp Aaron is another community-based service for kiddos. And there are also programs kind of erupting within schools. So if you think about schools, school is children's work, and kids spend the majority of their day in, or children spend the majority of their day in schools. Mm-hmm. And so some programs are actually infiltrating the school system.
That's great.
And utilizing, you know, school psychologists, counselors, and other school personnel to provide support throughout the school day. Mm-hmm. Because we know that as a response to grief, sometimes that can manifest in academic declines and so forth.
Many times it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Difficulties concentrating and so forth.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just the child feeling vulnerable after the death of a sibling, mm-hmm. and almost maybe feeling like a little off or a little odd, or that like their other kids are staring at them or
yes.
making fun of them behind their backs or whatever, you know, just having that extra sensitivity that they carry along with them.
Absolutely. As I've thought about some of the kids that I worked with at Children's, it was not uncommon for me during the process of that child dying to actually visit the school and have conversations to psychoeducate the teachers and school personnel, as well as think about when that sibling returns, how are we going to welcome them and reintegrate them into the environment in as seamless way as possible, so that they don't feel like all eyeballs are on me or I feel isolated. How can we have the conversations to memorialize their loved one should they choose? And also including that child in that planning process. So when you come back to school, how would you like that transition to look?
Mm-hmm.
So that, again, back to this sense of control as much as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember when I was in elementary school and there was one of my classmates that had cancer, and you know, everybody was either trying not to stare at this girl,
mm-hmm.
or just pretend like she didn't even exist. I mean, it was just some real discomfort going on around her,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just being able to say a few words to her every once in a while just to comfort her, because I remember I felt so bad for her,
mm-hmm.
that I eventually had said something once, you know, I figured whatever with their discomfort, I can't control the other people, but I can control how I'm going to respond to this poor girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it made a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, just she sparked up and was like, okay, great. Somebody's talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like an alien here. I don't mm-hmm. feel like, you know, like I don't belong anymore just because I've got this terminal illness that it's so radically changed my life.
Absolutely. I think as one element of the treatment plan that can be very important with a sibling of a child who's died is to help that sibling learn their boundaries. So when their sibling's brought up, how can we almost role play? What are the conversations that you're going to share? What are the things that you want to say, so that they've almost practiced in advance? Because it is awkward, and they know yes. that there's this elephant in the room. I've had kids describe it as, gosh, I walk into the room and it just sucks the air out, or I feel like the buzzkill. So helping them think through and anticipate those types of situations, and how can you help penetrate that, maybe through humor, or maybe through bringing up your loved one so that other people aren't worried about bringing it up and making mm-hmm. you feel awkward. So just kind of negotiating that in advance as much as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Boy, it sounds like a lot of psychoeducation.
A lot. Yes.
Yeah.
I have been absolutely shocked as I've gone to do community visits, whether it be schools or whatever, kind of the stigma that is associated with being a survivor of someone who's died. And so I think that psychoeducation goes such a long way in educating not only the survivor, but also those who interact with him or her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, the families that have worked with you are very fortunate.
Oh, thank you. You're so kind. You're so kind.
Because I can tell you have a real passion for this and a gift, and just, you know, you're talking about this so naturally. So I can just imagine sitting with you mm-hmm. and being in this position and just feeling comforted mm-hmm. that you could take me along with the process, and I would feel much better about what's about to happen up ahead, or let my loss go a little bit easier mm-hmm. as time passes on.
Thank you so much. this is something that is so near and dear to me. And as much as I think that I'm benefiting families, I can't tell you the gifts that they offer me on a daily basis. It has absolutely helped me shape kind of how I live my life and the things that I consider meaningful and the decisions that I make. So it really is them blessing my life more, much more so than I give to them.
Sounds very existential.
It is.
Yes, that's wonderful. And as we're wrapping up, do you have any advice to give anybody that is in this position?
As a parent or as a survivor?
Either one, just maybe one sentence about both or just closing thoughts about both.
I think that I'll actually take the perspective of you are a family member or a friend of someone who's lost a loved one. I would say hands down that the best thing you can do for them is to be available and to listen. When it comes to death and loss, there is no right or wrong. There are no right things to say. And the reality is that there's not going to be anything that you can say to bring that loved one back. So being available as a resource and allowing that person to have a safe space to share whenever and however they feel is most meaningful for them is my best recommendation.
That's great. And compassion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So if anybody wants to contact you, can they do so by your email address or?
Absolutely. I work at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, so they can email me at Mikel, M-E-K-E-L, Harris, at thechicagoschool.edu, or they can also reach me by telephone at 213-615-7257.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Dr. Harris.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate
you being here.
I really appreciate you giving me the space to have this conversation.
Thank you. And if anybody would like to contact me, my email address is jgood8@verizon.net. I have a private practice down in Irvine, California. And my phone number to reach me for appointments or questions is 562-234-4650. I would really like to thank my board operator, Jenny Guzman. Great girl, love her. And the executive producer, Jeremy Hansen. Thank you so much for allowing this space to have these great conversations and to get this information out that's so important nowadays. And I would like to thank you for listening this evening. I am going to be live on Tuesday nights for the next 8 weeks, or probably until the end of the year. We are doing a rebroadcast on Monday nights between 7 and 8 p.m. on my regular slot. I'm also available at iTunes Store under podcast on Psych One-on-One. That's P-S-Y-C-H One-on-One. And we are at skidrowstudios.com. You can pull up the archives on this show or any other shows at any time. So thank you so much for joining us. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.